From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump announced via tweet today that he'll name his Supreme Court nominee tomorrow night. He also signed an executive order that says that will significantly cut regulations for small business. But it's the president's executive orders from late last week that still have much of the nation reeling. On Friday night, Trump signed temporary travel bans on refugees and people coming into the United States from 7 Muslim-majority countries. By Saturday, protests had erupted at several U.S. cities and at airports as legal permanent residents were detained, foreign academics were sent home, and some refugees were turned away. Well, joining us now with more is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hello there, Ron.
Good to be with you.
Well, first of all, can we start with how the president reacted today on Twitter to all that happened across the country yesterday? He tweeted blame at Senate minority leaders and as well as Delta Airlines. What happened there?
There was a major disruption for Delta Airlines because of a systems crash over the weekend, and that did, in fact, disrupt traffic at a number of American airports. But, you know, there had been one the week before for United, and that got cleared up perhaps a little bit more clearly. A little bit more quickly. But the people who were protesting and carrying signs and the people who were being detained and being questioned, that didn't have anything to do with Delta's systems. That had entirely to do with the president's executive action. And that's why those big crowds were in the airports. Mm.
Now, we know that the executive action calls for a suspension of new refugee admissions for 120 days and a 90-day ban on people entering the country from those 7 Muslim-majority countries. But the Secretary of Homeland Security had to issue a statement last night clarifying what would happen with green card holders. Tell us about that.
That's right, because on Friday and Saturday, the Department of Homeland Security had initially said that the ban applied to green card holders. Now, those people are legal permanent residents of the United States. And so a lot of them got stopped and a lot of them got questioned, and they were, of course, not accustomed to this. And so all kinds of people who had other kinds of papers and were not actually citizens of those 7 countries or immediately traveling from one of those 7 countries, including a BBC journalist who's a British citizen, were detained and were extensively questioned because of the confusion over the order. That has now been walked back by the Department of Homeland Security.
Well, so Ron, let's talk a little bit more about that, because there seems to have been some significant confusion within the administration itself about how to implement this ban. I mean, what do we know about how much or even how little the Department of Homeland Security was consulted about the other branches of government that would have to enact this ban prior to the president signing the executive orders?
Well, some of the people who might normally have been involved in this in some of the departments, Homeland Security and State and so on, have been dismissed in recent days, have left because of the transition between the administrations. And then there was also apparently some degree of haste involved here. And the president explained this today by saying that there were some bad dudes who would have gotten into the country had this been pre-announced if we had said we were going to do it. So in order to catch those presumed bad dudes in mid-transit, the order was hurried up on Friday. And so, for example, one group of officials in the Homeland Security Department and other folks are reported to have been literally meeting to consider the president's executive action when they looked up and saw the television and the president was signing the action and holding it up for the cameras. Mm.
Now, Senator John McCain has been outspoken about this. He said on Twitter yesterday that he feared these executive orders will, quote, become a self-inflicted wound in the fight against terrorism. Tell us a little bit more about how Congress is reacting.
Yes, Senator McCain and also Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, two Republicans who often act in tandem, have objected to this vociferously. There has also been criticism from 4 or 5 other Republicans and very lukewarm support from some of the Republican senators as well. Mitch McConnell saying he could have been handled in another manner. He has had the support, however, of Speaker Paul Ryan and much of the House of Representatives. Those Republicans seem to be much more eager to get on board even for this kind of handling of such an executive action.
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, many thanks as always.
Thank you, Meghna.
Well, that executive action blocking refugees, as we said, has sparked outrage and protests. People who feel it's the opposite of what America stands for. People like Adham Sahlul, a Syrian-American from Chicago, who's working now for a humanitarian organization in Turkey, and he joins us via Skype. Adham, do you think that you, as a Syrian-American, will not be able to come back into the country because of this order?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. it's worth pointing out, and always in these conversations, it's worth pointing out the, you know, relative privilege. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. My father's a physician. I have green eyes and blonde hair. I don't really get, I don't have a beard. I don't wear the headscarf. People don't give me problems until they see my name on my passport. So I've never really encountered, you know, real discrimination at airports or at customs. But, you know, I worry as to whether I'll be able to, you know, visit, see my family anytime soon, or at least in the short term, as the first 120 days or first 90 days or so of the implementation of the executive order plays through.
Well, and when Reince Priebus, the president's chief of staff, comes out and says, well, anybody that's traveling to one of these countries should expect to have hours of interrogation when they try to come back into the U.S. What do you say to that? Because that's the argument that a number of people are making, that, you know, if you're going to go to Yemen or you're going to go to Syria, why shouldn't you be questioned significantly when you return to the United States?
Right. I'm all for people doing their jobs. My cousin's a police officer. I have great respect for, you know, people at the front lines, our TSA officers, if it's making us safer. But there is nothing in this executive order that's making us safer. In fact, this could make us less safe.
Why do you say that? What do you mean? What would make us less safe from this?
Well, this is building animosity, or even more animosity, within the Muslim world. It reinforces the us and them narrative that the extremists on both sides that they are peddling. I think just yesterday there were jihadist groups, Islamic State on Islamic State social media. They were praising the Muslim ban, that this is exactly what they wanted to prove, that the West is against Muslims. And this is the kind of thing that is that drives radicalization. So nothing in the form of a pragmatic analysis of where are the security gaps in the visa programs? Which are the countries where any of the terrorist attacks in the past 10 to 20 years have occurred? Which countries should we be singling out? Those are the kind of questions we should be asking. But as just today, Lawfare broke that hundreds of Foreign Service officers are reportedly penning a letter to the State Department's dissent channel saying that, you know, we're the ones who are working in the consulates. We're the ones that are issuing passports and visas and so on. We're the ones who understand the political dynamics around the world. And we're saying that this is going to sour relations, that this is going to have an economic impact on the U.S. You know, there's over $250 billion from travelers that came to the U.S. Just in 2015. There's a humanitarian impact, people who are visiting the U.S. for medical treatment, people like me or others who work for NGOs that need to travel to these areas, these conflict zones. And then this will actually create a burden. We need to just talk about the not just from us here in the States and how this will impact the States and our security, but this is a real burden on refugees, people who are fleeing bombardment, people who are fleeing persecution. And the U.S. has taken, you know, relative to its GDP and its size, has taken an embarrassingly low amount of refugees, particularly from Syria in the past 5 years since the conflict has been raging, compared to, you know, Canada and Germany and Sweden, not to mention the countries bordering, the first asylum countries bordering Syria, like Turkey, where I am, or Lebanon, or Jordan. You know, we hear about stories in our history classes since elementary school in the U.S., you know, about Ellis Island and the Statue of Liberty and how this is a country that was built by immigrants and refugees from fleeing religious persecution in Great Britain and Europe and otherwise. And, it's sad that we're going against everything that, you know, America was built on.
Well, one of the things that President Trump has talked about is establishing safe zones in Syria, basically with the idea that rather than having refugees flee the area and go into Europe or come to the United States or go to Jordan or other countries in the region, that if there were safe zones in Syria, that they could just stay there. As somebody who is on the ground in the region, is that a realistic thing?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to, I can't look into people's hearts, but I doubt that President Trump is doing anything really with care for what the Syrians are actually feeling and what they actually want. But according to a survey in 2015, which surveyed close to 900 Syrian refugees living in Germany, 92% of them wanted to go back to Syria. They didn't want to stay in Europe. But to create a safe zone, you would need leverage on the ground. And President Obama has lost, you know, almost all leverage the United States has on the ground in Syria, aside from the coalition forces bombing ISIS. You know, where you would create a safe zone, who would enforce it. These are all intricate policy issues that President Trump has not answered yet.
That's Adham Sahloul, who is a Syrian-American from the United States, but working right now for a humanitarian organization in Turkey. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's take a break from our top story for a moment to talk about what might be the top story at your workplace, that everyone is coughing and sneezing right now. We've talked about some tips to stay healthy at work, including getting enough sleep at night, and we'll link you to that conversation at hereandnow.org. But scientists are currently working on a study about how microbial communities living inside buildings affect our health. And joining us now is one of the scientists involved in the research, Jordan Pechia, who's a professor of chemical and environmental engineering at Yale. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to talk about microbes and buildings.
Well, and for those of us who work in buildings that are sealed off, in other words, you can't open the windows, which a lot of buildings are these days, what's around us?
Well, it doesn't matter whether the building is sealed off or not, but what is around you is microorganisms. Probably the largest types of microorganisms or the major sources is you yourself or some other person that's been in the building. If the building is sealed off, there's probably more around you than if it's not sealed off.
And is it harmful to us?
Some are harmful to you and some may be beneficial to you.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, the harmful ones are the ones that we know about. So, for instance, it could be influenza. It could be norovirus from somebody who was sick and in a waiting room before you. Some of the beneficial ones could be certain microorganisms that came off of your pets that have been shown to have some effect in reducing the risk in developing childhood asthma.
And is there anything you ought to be doing to protect yourself against the bad microbes that are around us?
Well, there's, you know, all the recommendations that are made by the Centers for Disease Control. There's washing your hands. There's keeping surfaces clean. There's covering your mouth when you sneeze. But one of the points of our reports is that we shouldn't be thinking about sterilizing every surface around us, that our immune systems, especially the immune systems of our children, need to develop and they need microbial exposures. Since we spend at least 90% of our time in houses and other buildings and in our cars, you know, we're going to have to get those exposures in buildings.
At this time of year, it seems like everybody gets sick in the office pretty quickly. One person gets sick and then everybody else does. Is that because of what we're talking about here?
That's partly because of it. It depends on what type of agent you get sick with. But it has to do certainly with just the density of people in a certain environment. Ventilation systems often recirculate much of the air to save energy. Buildings now, especially occupied buildings like offices, are built with a tight envelope and they try to ventilate them. Sometimes they add more outdoor air, sometimes not so much. And for certain agents like influenza, it turns out that the relative humidity, the low humidity in the winter, tends to help those organisms survive longer.
Would you say generally that people who work in offices where they can open the windows are healthier than those who work in offices where they can't open the windows?
I don't know if that's a generalization we could make. I certainly know that, you know, in the last 2 months, I've moved from a building where I can open the windows to one where I cannot, and you feel trapped. There is certainly clear epidemiology that shows that if you ventilate your home more, or if you have more outdoor air ventilation, even in an office building, that you'll have fewer health effects than if you have a low ventilated building.
So you're studying this and you're going to come out with a report at some point this year. What are you trying to find out that you don't already know?
Well, what we're really trying to find out is there's been a lot of fundamental research into this areas of what types of microbes are growing in buildings. We have fundamental research on now a growing body in the human microbiome and what makes us sick and what makes us well. We're trying to develop, say, a roadmap from this fundamental research into actually designing buildings, thinking about how we occupy buildings and how we might modify buildings in such a way that we encourage the right types of microorganisms to be exposed to, whether it's discouraging the bad ones or encouraging the good ones.
And when you think of all of the things that go into designing a building and cost and architecture and energy efficiency and all that, you think that people are going to think about your issue when they're considering their new building?
We hope so. You know, for example, this National Academy's report is a has members from the field of architecture. It has engineers on the committee. It has material scientists on the committee, as well as doctors, epidemiologists, and microbiologists. So we're trying to keep every group at the table. The other sort of fundamental part of this is that much of our health is dependent on our exposure to microorganisms. In the United States, we get about 1 billion respiratory infections each year. We know that we spend much of our time in buildings. There's just got to be some sort of, idea about how to design buildings to make us well in the future. And so we think that it's important enough and that we can design around these trade-offs or find innovative ways to think about trade-offs between building energy, materials, et cetera, that we can design buildings that have these better exposures.
That's Jordan Pechia, who is a professor of chemical and environmental engineering at Yale University and one of the researchers writing the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine study on microbial communities in buildings. Very interesting. Jordan, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure.
Well, another bit of health news here. With more and more people, especially young people, using new headphones and earbuds, doctors have a warning. They pose a potential health hazard. Studies show hearing loss among kids and teens is up about 30% more than it was in the 80s and 90s, and experts believe earphones are part of the problem. Lori Mack from here, now contributor WNPR in Hartford, reports.
When it comes to your hearing, it's all about volume and time exposure. The louder the sound, the faster the damage. As a benchmark, a normal conversation is about 60 decibels, considered a safe level, not loud enough to cause damage. But increase it to 85 decibels? That's about the volume of your vacuum. Now we've reached a critical level. Michelle Abrams, clinical audiologist at Southern Connecticut State University, explains the intensity-time trade-off when measuring sound.
When we think of decibel levels, when we think of loudness levels, it's really incremental. So it's a logarithmic scale. So we know that 85 dB is that critical level. 85 dB, 8 hours a day, that's your maximum. If it's 90 dB, 5 dB greater, you have to cut your time in half.
Many smartphones, tablets, and music devices can generate maximum volume levels of over 100 decibels, loud enough to cause hearing problems after just 15 minutes a day. The damage is caused when the hair cells in the inner ear, which help transmit sound to the brain, are exposed to loud sounds. If you've ever been to a concert and you've experienced ringing in your ears afterwards, that's a sign of damage. Sometimes that damage is only temporary, but sometimes it's permanent. Abrams says it all depends on how loud, how long, and how often.
Repeated exposure damages your hair cells. So it would be like walking on blades of grass, and you step on the grass, and the grass flattens, but it comes back up. And the more you do it, the more it stays down, and eventually it doesn't come back up. So it becomes permanent.
And earphones, because they're inserted directly into the ear canal, can be a little more problematic, says Dr. Mary Ellen Flaherty Hewitt. She's medical director for pediatric primary care at Yale New Haven Children's Hospital.
The other issue with the earbuds is many of the teenagers are using what comes with their devices, which are not custom fit, so they allow in a lot of ambient noise, which then makes them turn the volume up. So they want to block out the ambient noise, they turn the volume up. Now it's at louder decibels.
The damage is usually gradual, but it's not just that you're hearing at a lower volume. Sounds become muffled and distorted over time. Back at Southern Connecticut State University, audiologist Michelle Abrams demonstrates in a small lab.
Imagine this is an audiogram, and this is a graph of somebody's hearing.
Abrams plays three examples of the same conversation. The idea is to hear what hearing loss sounds like.
So this is how it would sound if your hearing was normal.
You're just going to sit here and listen. How was your day?
I don't want to talk about work. The less I talk about work, the better I feel, especially on my day off.
This is how it would sound if you had a mild, high-frequency hearing loss.
Okay, so you're not going to be able to do this. Is that what you're telling me?
I'm telling you that's probably what I'm going to do, not do it.
You're just going to sit here and listen.
And this is how it would sound if you had a moderate to severe high-frequency hearing loss.
How was your day?
I don't want to talk about work. The less I talk about work, the better I feel, especially on my day off.
Okay, so you're not going to be able to do this. Is that what you're telling me?
I'm telling you that's probably what I'm going to do, not do it.
You're just going to sit here and listen.
Yeah.
So when it comes to listening to mobile devices, how much is too much and what's too loud?
There's generally what we consider to be kind of the 60-60 rule. So 60% of the volume for 60 minutes. That should be your maximum.
Custom earphones designed to drown out background noise for listening at a lower volume can help, along with apps that measure decibel levels to show noise exposure. And because it's easy for volume levels to creep up, some smartphones offer the ability to go into settings and limit the maximum volume. But a recent investigation by the New York Times found that not all volume-limiting technology does the job. For Here and Now, I'm Laurie Mack in Hartford.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service you've heard about. Its mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to all. They support a more sustainable food system, set the highest standards for ingredients, and make it easy and fun to cook. You decide which recipes and how many meals you want each week. Change, pause, or cancel anytime. Learn more at blueapron.com/here. Go now and get your first three meals free, plus free shipping at blueapron.com/here.
Flags are at half-mast in Quebec City the morning after six were killed and more than a dozen injured in a mass shooting at a local mosque. The killings shocked Quebec City residents, where the murder rate is among the lowest in Canada and shootings are rare. The dead were all men, ranging in age from 35 to 70. Karen McDonald is news director at Global Montreal, and she joins us from Quebec City. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, I understand that the suspects who were apprehended last night have been named. Who are they and what do we know about them?
Well, their names are Alexandre Bissonnette and Mohamed Kadir. They haven't been charged yet, but multiple sources have named them. It sounds like Alexandre Bissonnette was a student at Laval University, which is less than a mile from the scene of the shooting. And unfortunately, we know even less about Mohamed Kadir. That name is as common in the Muslim community as, say, John Smith might be. So far, we're having a very hard time tracking down people who might have known him.
Well, so tell us a little bit more about the Muslim community there in Quebec City. I understand there's a population of about 6,700 out of a city of, what, 750,000?
That's right. It's a very small community, composed primarily of two types of people. People who have come to Quebec City to study at Laval University. Laval is one of the biggest universities in Quebec, and because it's a French-speaking university, Muslims from French-speaking countries like Algeria, for example, or other African countries have gravitated towards Quebec City and then often stay. It's a very nice place to live. The other part of the community came to Canada, to Quebec, as either refugees or immigrants, and tend to be business people. And those were the people, many of the people who were praying last night at the mosque when the shooting took place.
So what more do we know then about the victims?
We don't know very much. Very few of them have been identified as yet. They were entrepreneurs, business owners, intellectuals, professors. All of these people worked in the region and prayed at the mosque in Saint-Ouen.
Now, I understand that it was also announced this morning that there could be other suspects as well. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that three levels of police in the province are in Quebec City, so the city police, the provincial police, as well as the RCMP, and that they have the SWAT team, police dogs. They have been searching homes. Some people were seen leaving a home very close to the mosque with police this morning. The police have not yet said whether other people are under arrest. This is all part of the investigation, we were told by police in their first update this morning, but it certainly looks like they think there may have been other people connected to this tragic shooting. Mm.
And Karen, tell us more about how Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is responding. He's issued a statement, and he's also had an interesting week saying that Canada would accept any Muslim refugees that are barred under President Donald Trump's executive order. But how has he responded specifically to what happened in Quebec City?
Well, we certainly heard from all levels of politicians that they feel that this is a very tragic event and that we stand by and support our Muslim community who are 100% Quebecers or Canadians or both. The Prime Minister will be addressing that in question period in the House of Commons in Ottawa this afternoon, and then he will be traveling to Quebec City with the Leader of the Opposition to attend a memorial service in Quebec City.
Well, Karen McDonald is News Director at Global Montreal. Karen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
President Donald Trump is expected to announce his first Supreme Court nomination tomorrow night. The nominee will likely come from a list of conservative judges and lawyers identified by his transition team earlier this month. Some Democrats are already saying they'll block Trump's pick. Of course, there's almost always some resistance to any Supreme Court nominee, even legendary ones. Take, for example, the late Justice Thurgood Marshall, the first black justice on the high court, and the man who argued Brown v. Board, the case that desegregated American schools. 11 senators voted against his confirmation in 1967, most of them Democrats from the Deep South. Marshall retired from the court in 1991. He was 83, and at his retirement announcement, a reporter asked the justice whether he thought Martin Luther King's famous line, "Free at last, thank God Almighty we are free at last rang true for him.
Well, I'm not free. All I know is that years ago, when I was a youngster, a Pullman porter told me that he had been in every city in this country, he was sure, and he had never been in any city in the United States where he had to put his hand up in front of his face to find out he was a Negro. I agree with it.
That's the late Justice Thurgood Marshall in 1991. And this is the Marshall we meet at the beginning of the one-man play, Thurgood. It's on now at the New Repertory Theater in Watertown, Massachusetts. And I recently spoke with playwright George Stevens Jr. and actor Johnny Lee Davenport. And I began by asking Davenport what it means to him to be performing this show now.
Well, this is my first one-man show. And to, first of all, George, Mr. Stevens, thank you for this opportunity to say these words and to tell this story in the way that you've written it. It's fantastic. I really, really want to say thank you. And I have to say my wife is a big fan.
But, oh, that is great.
But to tell this story and to realize how relative it is right now is just mind-boggling. The connections that are made. For instance, our new president may have the opportunity to appoint four Supreme Court justices during his first 4 years. And in the play, you find out that Nixon did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just phenomenal.
Well, George Stevens Jr., let me ask you. Thurgood premiered on Broadway back in 2008, and I believe its first performances given the year, happened even before Barack Obama began his first term. So what inspired you to write a one-man play about Thurgood Marshall?
I had, years before, directed and written a mini-series for television called Separate But Equal that was the story of Brown versus the Board of Education, and Sidney Poitier played Thurgood Marshall. And some years after that, I was having dinner with Sidney and his wife Joanne and my wife Liz in Los Angeles, and I asked Sidney what he was up to. And Sidney, in that rather stately way of his, said, "It has been 40 years since I did Raisin in the Sun. I want to go back to Broadway." And I don't know where it came from, but I said, well, why don't I write a play about Thurgood Marshall? And I sentenced myself. And then about 8 months later, I gave it to him in Sydney. We had lived in the same building and had apartments in Los Angeles, and Sydney would come down and read it and said, I'm moving into a house and I'm going to learn the play. And a little while later, he invited me up for lunch, and he said, I am 75 years old. I cannot learn your play. So that provided an opportunity for many fine actors.
Yeah. Well, and one of them who's sitting across the table from me here now, today, I mean, so you mentioned Brown versus Board. Of course, that is the 1954 ruling that desegregated American schools, the landmark case that most people may remember Justice Marshall for. But, I mean, he was obviously a very powerful legal figure for the NAACP even before that. I mean, Johnny Lee Davenport, tell me, how do you get into the mind, the rhythm of a man like Thurgood Marshall on stage?
The words are there. And all I have to do is honor the language, honor the words. What I've learned is that Thurgood had such an immense wit and intellect and sense of humor. And so from this play that is full of facts and full of dates and full of, I'll call it legalese, it's distilled down to a man who has gone through so many changes in his life, who has confronted so many obstacles to forward his passion.
Yeah.
It starts out where he's able to watch Negro prisoners being beaten in a Northwest Baltimore police station. And that has stayed with him. And he says at the end, that is why I've done everything in my power to protect the civil rights of every American citizen. Hmm. And this passion, he wouldn't let go of this burning fire. But I endeavor to bring the humanity of the man. And it's not hard because the words are there,
mm-hmm.
and it's inherent in the speech, and I honor language. I love language,
yeah.
And the words I get to say are just brilliant.
Well, George,
that sense of humor of Thurgood is a blessing, isn't it, Mr. Davenport?
It certainly is.
Well, George Stevens, tell us more about that, because I think, you know, people obviously remember Marshall for his legal victories, but his life away from the court is also part of the play. How did you weave that in?
Well, there's a great deal of a record around of his, you know, his what he's said over the years, and you know, weaving that together. You know, I think one reason for me wanting to do the play was I have great respect for Dr. King and all that he achieved and what he went through to achieve it, but I felt that Thurgood is under-recognized in that area, because without Thurgood Marshall, there is no Dr. King, because
right.
Thurgood Marshall was the architect, as he used to say, using the law like a weapon.
I want to play one more piece of tape from Justice Marshall himself, actually. This is from 1988, and he spoke to a group called the Judicial Council. They had given him a ward. And really, you hear his passion, which never waned, of continuing the efforts of the civil rights movement.
We claim that we have made great advances. A lot of people do. I mean, I'm in the group that doesn't believe that. And some of you might not want to hear what I have to say about the problems that still remain. Why, when you get in high office, you do that? Well, I'll tell you why. As long as I've got breath, I am going to say it. And I'm going to repeat it over and over again.
It's Justice Thurgood Marshall speaking in 1988. Johnny Lee Davenport, this play is being performed at a very pivotal moment in the American story. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us about the, I feel a sense of optimism in the play near the end that may be particularly moving to audiences now.
Yeah, I'd like to do the final poem by Langston Hughes, some of that.
Yeah.
And it'll give you an indication of the hope that is built into the play. It is a play that has hope built into it.
Because Marshall and Langston Hughes knew each other.
They were schoolmates. They went to Lincoln College together. And, let America be America again. The land that never has been yet and yet must be. The land where every man is free. The land that is mine. The poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain must bring back our mighty dream again. Oh, yes, I say it plain. America never was America to me. And yet, I swear this oath, America will be.
Johnny Lee Davenport, performing a poem by Langston Hughes, which closes the one-man play Thurgood. We also spoke with playwright George Stevens Jr.
There's been reaction from the business community to President Trump's temporary order suspending entry into the U.S. for people from a number of Muslim-majority countries. Starbucks is promising to hire 10,000 refugees around the world over the next 5 years. Lyft is pledging $1 million for the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, which has been fighting the order in court. Google has set up a crisis fund, and Airbnb is offering free housing to people who can't enter the U.S. because of the order. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So when you look at these companies pushing back against the president, some of the ones we mentioned there are companies from Silicon Valley, but what's the motivation?
You know, there's some policies where it'd be simple to explain the motivation behind such a strong reaction. You know, if the president makes it harder for tech companies, let's say, to hire foreign PhDs, you would just say, all right, well, this policy affects the bottom line for these companies. This is clearly just about economics. But the reaction from Silicon Valley and the reaction beyond Silicon Valley in the business world has been something more like moral disgust, that this is a policy that isn't merely about economics. It's about people trying to scale up and say, this is about questions regarding who are we as Americans. Google's founder went to protest at FSO in San Francisco's International Airport. The CEO of Box said, quote, on every level, moral, humanitarian, economic, logical, the ban was wrong. So you have this outpouring of moral sentiment that's coming from the business community and, I must say, particularly from the tech community.
But also from others. Ford CEO Mark Fields today said that he opposes the ban. He's the first CEO of a major U.S. automaker to do so.
Right. You have a lot of non-tech businesses right now who are coming out and sometimes being a little bit more measured. GE's response simply expressed concern. Ford, as you said, became the first major U.S. automaker to criticize the immigration order. Goldman Sachs has made it clear that they don't support the order. Starbucks was even more forceful. So, yes, I do think this is something where the tech community, I think, has been the most outspoken and certainly the most shared on social media. But you're beginning to see something of a herding effect here, with corporations seeing that if they remain silent, their silence itself will be the deafening thing.
Well, let's talk about what happened with Uber and Lyft over the weekend, because they seem to be on the opposite side of things for a time.
It's totally fascinating. So here's the story. The New York City taxi lobby encouraged its members, many of whom are Muslim, to strike for an hour at JFK. Uber, however, stayed open for business, as it were, which meant that Uber drivers were essentially breaking the strike and undercutting the protest, which a lot of people caught on to and started tweeting #DeleteUber and other things critical of Uber, which essentially got Lyft, an Uber competitor, to announce announced in response that it was going to make a $1 million donation, as you said, to the ACLU. So here you have Lyft seeing somewhat of a business opportunity, certainly a marketing opportunity, to step over Uber and its CEO's response, which was seen as being too wishy-washy. Then Uber, in response to Lyft, says that it's going to create a $3 million legal defense fund for drivers, and finally comes out and says the executive order is wrong and unjust. So the upshot of this story is not merely this little tit-for-tat, but the way that corporate responses to the Trump administration are going to feed off each other and create this social influence whereby the reactions are going to snowball over 24 hours, 48 hours, as companies realize there is a marketing advantage in additional to a moral imperative to stand up against these sort of initiatives.
I have to say, just on a side note about that, I did find it odd that the taxi drivers in New York who were trying to protest this order stopped driving to JFK, because I imagine a lot of the people that wanted to go to JFK at that time were protesters who wanted
to be upset
to get there, or people getting off of planes after they had been through a lot of interrogation and then wanted to get into the city.
And I would just say, Jeremy, this is a tough thing about public protests. You've seen people complaining, I couldn't get access to JFK because there were too many people protesting. Mm. Or in previous protests, I couldn't drive to, get home from work because there were people protesting in the roads. And so you have these waves and backlashes that are happening with the responses to the Trump administration's actions.
Well, and it does put these companies in a difficult position, it sounds like, because we had heard a lot about companies trying to curry favor with Trump and do things that he wanted them to do, announce big plans to, put new jobs in the United States or not move a factory out of the country. But at the same time, in this case, it sounds like they're stuck between their customers who want them to do something and the president who wants them to do the opposite.
The other thing to put in there, I mean, everything that you said is absolutely right. And the sort of Damocles or the sort of Twitter, literally, that's hanging over their head is the possibility that Donald Trump, if he's mad at Lyft or mad at Ford or mad at Oracle or something, is going to tweet something terrible about that company, and their stock price is going to fall. And now they violated their fiduciary duty by potentially coming out too aggressively in response to an executive order. So I do think that they're walking a fine line between expressing personal feelings about morality and what America is for and its long-term relationship with the immigrant community of the rest of the world, while not trying to invoke the President of the United States' anger, in which case he could tweet absolutely anything at 6:30 in the morning and crash your stock.
That's Derek Thompson at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks.
Thank you.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.